Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
We might like to think that politics is kept out of the clinics, wards, and operating rooms where medicine is practiced, but sadly, that isn't the case. Laws enacted by states across the union can trigger first, second, and third-order consequences for patients and providers alike. Today, we will discuss interesting new research on residency applications for programs in abortion-restricted states. Next on Sound Practice. My guests today are Anisha Gongoli and Anna Morentz. Dr. Gongoli is Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Morentz is an Assistant Professor of Medicine at the University of Arizona. My guests have co-authored an article entitled State-Level Disparities in Residency Applications After Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. The article appears on JAMA Network Open. Dr. Gongoli and Dr. Morentz, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure. Before we get into your very interesting article, I'd like to ask each of you to tell me a little bit about your backgrounds.
Great. I am an assistant professor of medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Dr. Morentz and I actually trained together in residency at the University of Washington. So that's how we became to be friends and future research collaborators. We are both primary care physicians. We both are trained in internal medicine and practice primary care. And we're both clinician investigators as well. So we have a primary research careers focused on health services research, policy-informed research, addressing social needs. Both of us have an interest in cancer screening. We came to this topic almost as a side project, based on observations that we were seeing among our peers in the healthcare workforce. Given that we had robust research training, I completed a postdoctoral fellowship at UT Southwestern and in their county health system, Parkland Health, and got dedicated time to develop my health services research skills there. Dr. Morentz will tell you a little bit about her research experience, and we were able to bring our skills together and work on this project.
Great. And I'm Dr. Anna Morentz, and I'm similar to Dr. Gongoli, a primary care physician and researcher at the University of Arizona. And a lot of my research has focused on evaluating the health impacts of various policies across the US, including Medicaid expansion policies and their impact on patients' receipt of organ transplant, the impacts of paid sick leave policies on colorectal cancer screening. And so this was an exciting expansion on that work to look at the impacts of state-level abortion restrictions on our healthcare workforce in the form of residency applications. And I completed my master's in public health at the University of Washington after residency, and took a class on causal inference methods, which is sort of the key group of methodologies used for policy evaluation work under Dr. Anirban Basu, who is a co-author on this article as well, and provided a lot of methodologic rigor and expertise.
Very nice. Dr. Morentz, in June of 2022, the United States Supreme Court released its opinion in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organizations. Can you talk about that opinion and its significance to healthcare?
Yeah, so happy to. As we know, the June 2022 Supreme Court decision overturned the former decision from the 1970s of Roe versus Wade, and essentially returned abortion policy decisions to individual states instead of allowing a nationwide protection for abortion rights for women. And so as a result, following that decision, you saw a patchwork emerge of abortion policies across the U.S. Many states had been anticipating and preparing for this decision and had so-called trigger laws that were restrictions on abortion at a certain gestational age, you know, whether 6 weeks of gestation, 10 weeks, et cetera, that were ready to go in effect if Roe versus Wade was overturned. So, and I'm happy to talk more about our study, but I'll leave it at that. I think that's a good summary of where we were in summer of 2022.
That's helpful. And I think that'll serve as a reminder to some folks that may be familiar with the name of Roe v. Wade, but a little less familiar with Dobbs versus Jackson. So thank you. Dr. Nungley, the study that you took part on analyzed nearly 24 million residency applications across more than 4,300 programs. What prompted you to look beyond OBGYN at entire residency pipeline, and what did you expect to find?
Thanks for asking that question. So there have been really important studies that were previously published showing the impact of these state abortion restrictions on the OBGYN workforce and in the OBGYN training pipeline. And that makes a lot of sense because OBGYNs deliver the vast majority of abortion care in the United States. I was interested in looking at how this may be affecting our healthcare workforce more broadly, particularly through my lens as a primary care physician, because PCPs do deliver a lot of family planning services. We do counsel a lot of patients, preconception and around preparing for pregnancy. We diagnose pregnancy, and we do deliver some abortion care in the United States, increasingly so because abortion is the primary abortion modality in the U.S., particularly post-Dobbs. Those are reasons why specialties beyond OBGYN may be affected by these policies in their practice. It's also important to remember that resident physicians are individuals who are planning their own families during their young training years. And so they may be having personal reasons why they may choose the state where they want to train based on these policies themselves. So it felt like a good time to widen that lens that, when we think about abortion care, we think about the discipline of OBGYN. That should be our first instinct, but it may be a bigger problem than that. So we wanted to expand it to all specialties.
Dr. Morris, the headline finding in the study is that applications dropped in abortion-restricted states among both women and men. Many people would assume that this was primarily a women's issue. What does the decline among male applicants tell us?
Great question. So we wanted to stratify our analysis or separate our analysis out by self-identified gender between women and men because we were curious about that same question that you had asked. Obviously, we kind of view that there is both professional and personal reasons why applicants may prefer not to practice or complete their residency in a state with abortion restrictions. And our finding, and obviously many would surmise that the personal reasons could be more magnified for women applicants, particularly as residency is a time that often happens during prime childbearing years. So women may be thinking about having kids or starting a family during that time, but are finding that applications decrease significantly among men applicants as well, I think reflects that often these residency program decisions are being made with a family in mind. Often a partner may be coming along, you know, a spouse. Men may have children that they're being, that they are mindful of, as well as the professional ramifications of practicing their chosen specialty in a state with restrictions where they may feel like they're not able to provide the quality of care, the standard of care that they would like to. You know, I think there are also some of these states that have enacted abortion restrictions may also be more likely to enact other restrictions on, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion curriculum, for example. We weren't able to tease out those nuances in this study, but that's a future area of research that we've also been talking about, as that could similarly influence applicants' decisions about where to train.
Dr. Gongoli, the steepest declines in abortion-related specialty applications clearly in the OBGYN and family medicine areas. But what happens to patients in restricted states if those residency slots go unfilled?
So far, there haven't been a meaningful increase in unfilled residency slots. So it's important for us to emphasize our study looked at volume of applications submitted to residency programs. It does not tell us about match rates in those states. But a decreased volume of applications to certain states is an indicator of lower interest in going to those states. So, you know, we're planning future work to continue to follow this trend out to see, you know, how this may affect the training pipeline in those states long term. And the reason why the training pipeline matters is more than 50% of residents go on to practice in the state of their residency. So it's important where residents want to train because more than one in two will stay there to be the doctors in those states one day. When we think about, like, you know, the diminishing workforce in these states, you know, a lot of abortion restricted states had existing workforce shortages, particularly in primary care. And so I think when a lot of policymakers are considering the ramifications of these abortion policies, they're thinking about, well, we're turning off abortion care delivery in those states, but they don't think about, hey, this may impact the primary care provision in my state. We also found that emergency medicine was one of the specialties that were particularly affected by these policies. So, you know, I don't think a lot of policymakers contemplate like that these policies could affect, you know, the individual who's going to save you from your heart attack, you know, healthcare workforce supplies in your ERs and in your clinics, not just in family planning clinics.
Very interesting.
And I will add one thing, even though match rates are extremely high, kind of by virtue of how the residency match program works, we recently had another match cycle just happen in March, and there were two OBGYN residencies that did not fill all of their slots. Again, very unusual not to fill all of your slots. Both of those two programs were in Texas. So this is an area that needs further monitoring, and that's concerning.
Dr. Ranska, following up on that, it's interesting that some of the most competitive specialties, dermatology, neurosurgery, orthopedics, we're largely insulated from this trend. What does that tell us about the limits of physician choice in residency programs?
Yeah, this was an expected finding for us. So these are the most competitive specialties. Applicants are usually encouraged to apply very broadly to a high number of programs and generally feel, in some cases, lucky to match at all. And so if they wherever they match, that's where they're going to go. So in general, there's less agency in being choosy about where you might apply if you're applying to one of these most competitive specialties. And there, you know, there's been a lot written over the decades about the residency match system, court cases, you know, about how this does interfere with, you know, an individual's agency in choosing, because you don't have a, you know, five programs that would like to take you that you're deciding between that you ultimately pick. You know, you rank them, they rank you as the applicant, and then a computer algorithm matches them all together. But in terms of, you know, kind of the impact of abortion policies on residency applications, this was expected for us, that these individuals in the most competitive specialties would be more likely to still need to apply to programs wherever they might be, and be willing to potentially go places that they may not want to live long term, but in order to complete their training to go on to be, you know, the orthopedic surgeon that they've always dreamed of being.
Thank you. Dr. Congoli, can we talk about lag times? Because it seems like if there's a problem, it may not manifest itself due to the training regimen for some years. Am I right in that assumption?
I'm glad you brought that up. So this is a very early signal of a potential problem. And like I said, it doesn't even reflect a decreased supply of residents yet. It reflects a decreased level of interest from residents in abortion-restricted states. But there are many steps that may go on to confer bad patient outcomes in the future. So decreased interest may lead to decreased number of residents, aka unmatched slots for residency programs in these states. And that long term leads to a drier workforce in those states. And then when there are not enough doctors, that leads to bad patient outcomes. So it's something that we need to be monitoring very closely. And it's also important for us to clarify, you know, our study looked at the 1 year immediately post-ops. What really hasn't been shown yet is how durable these decreases are. You know, one of the potential things that we may see in future research is that there may be some evening out between abortion-restricted and non-restricted states. We don't know that yet until we evaluate the data, and that's something Dr. Morenz and I are pursuing.
Dr. Morenz, the data shows a gap in applications from women to abortion-restricted states even before Dobbs. What does that tell us about how reproductive health climate has been quietly shaping physician careers and decisions for years?
Yeah, I think this reflects the fact that there have been a lot of attacks on abortion access that have preceded the overturn of Roe versus Wade. And so listeners may be familiar with TRAP laws, which really started gaining momentum in the 2010s. And so those TRAP stands for Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers. But this was things like requiring physicians who performed abortions to have hospital admitting privileges, even though the risk of a complication that would lead to requiring a hospital admission is exceedingly low after what is a common outpatient procedure like a surgical abortion. So that's just kind of an example of the sorts of things that were happening that were leading to clinics to close or providers no longer to be providing these services. And that was likely something that women applicants may have been more likely to be tuned into, both for professional and personal reasons. And it may have taken kind of men applicants more the Dobbs decision really escalating these issues to a very visible national scale to feel a heightened sense of alarm about potentially practicing in some of these areas with restrictions.
I'll chime in there. You know, the pre-existing differences that we see among women prior to the Dobbs decision, absolutely, there are unfriendly reproductive climates that existed in these states. Dr. Morenz and I have been using this term reproductive climate more to reflect the broader landscape, which is not just provision of abortion services, but red tape to access contraception, you know, other parameters of family planning and female reproductive autonomy that women would be more aware of. And then exactly like Dr. Morenz described, the Dobbs decision resulted in all these policy changes happening very quickly, kind of unmasking a problem that suddenly the public consciousness, including men, became more aware of all of a sudden.
Were you at all surprised by the results that you found?
So originally we had hypothesized that the drop off in applications would be primarily among women. We had written into our analytic plans that we had expected to see primarily an effect among women applicants, not men applicants. So the decreases that we saw among men applicants, that opened my eyes to understanding that this is a wider problem, that men, it's not, we're not just going to lose women doctors in these states. We may lose men doctors too. This is an all of us problem. I want audiences to appreciate that. I want physicians to know that. I want policymakers to know that. And I want patients to know that, that it's not just a certain type of resident trainee who's going to be affected by this. It may be much bigger than we anticipate.
And this may be beyond the scope of your research at the moment, but it seems to me that you've looked at the beginning portion of a physician's career in these states in this area of medicine. And it would be interesting to look at those that have practiced for quite some time. Are we seeing individuals exiting the practice sooner than we might otherwise anticipate, taking early retirement in those states? Do you know of any research in that area?
That's actually the next step in our own research portfolio. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, maintains a database of where physicians are currently practicing, which is linked to a physician's national provider identifier, or NPI, which is given to them. Hopefully you heard me okay. My camera froze. Which is given to them when they graduate from medical school. So it's a lifelong identifier, and it reflects your practice address, which obviously can change if you move places. And so we are using that database to look at exactly that question. Are physicians in these states that have enacted restrictions more likely to be moving practices, or, as you say, potentially exiting the workforce? Which is a little bit trickier to tell, but there are kind of deactivations of one's NPI that can imply that someone may not be practicing anymore. So we agree that that's ultimately a really important question to understand longer term healthcare workforce impacts.
There are some initial reports that the average age of retirement for OBGYNs is getting younger in response to these policies that make it so difficult for OBGYNs to retain their autonomy in their practice. So it's definitely something that we need to be looking at. You know, our first study showed the signal among people starting their career, but I think an important question to answer is who's ending their career too early because of this.
To follow up on this research that you are moving forward with, I'm interested, is it difficult to get the data from CMS? And maybe Dr. Morenz could take that question.
Yes, it can be. It's all publicly available. But what you would search right now would just give you a snapshot in April 2026, who is practicing and where. But there is an incredible center for workforce or center for rural workforce, I'm not quite sure on the term, at the University of Washington that Dr. Basu, one of our co-authors who I mentioned, has collaborated with. And so they actually have these NPI files that they've maintained since, I believe, back to 2009, quite a long period of time, with either quarterly or yearly updates. And so they have agreed, you know, to allow us to use those data files to look at this question.
Very, very nice. Dr. Unglia, as our time together grows to an end, I'm interested in what other projects you and then Dr. Marantz can tell us are working on. It sounds like we found out about one. Are there other things that interest you? And what can we expect in the future from the two of you?
Yeah, so another aspect, you know, unanswered question about these policies is how does it affect patient outcomes? We both mentioned earlier, you know, in our primary care practice, cancer screening is one of the most important things that we deliver for patients. Dr. Marantz has proposed a really interesting analysis to understand what are the impacts of abortion restrictions on the provision of preventive care, you know, completion of preventive care. In fact, Senator Elizabeth Warren posted last week reminding her constituents that with all the questions around Planned Parenthood funding, closure of Planned Parenthood clinics doesn't just remove abortion services. It's also a critical access point for preventive care, which includes contraception, STI testing, and breast and cervical cancer screening, you know, some of the most life-saving aspects of preventive care that women need. So we're interested in quantifying that. We're interested in understanding, you know, how these policies may be affecting cancer screening for women.
Excellent. Dr. Marantz, do you have anything to add to that, or previews of what work you're coming up with?
No, not yet. I think Dr. Ganguly summarized it really well. So we're, you know, interested in kind of putting in some applications to get funding for data, kind of the robust data sources that we would need to really look at this question. And it's an important one, to echoing back to your question about lag time. You know, cancer screening is often every, you know, 3 to 10 years, depending on the type of cancer screening, or, you know, 2 to 10 years. So, and obviously cancers themselves take a very long time to develop potentially. And so we may need kind of more lag time and kind of the correct data to really get a sense for the impacts on these outcomes.
Excellent. My guests have been Anisha Ganguly and Anna Marantz. Their article is State Level Disparities in Residency Applications After Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. Doctors, thank you so much for your good work and the discussion today on Sound Practice.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. We enjoyed speaking with you today.
It's been my pleasure. My thanks to Doctors Ganguly and Marantz for their time and investigative abilities. Their research provides a level of self-examination that is useful to the profession. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpractice.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpractice.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. That man Robin, Rick Capow.